outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
Before we begin the podcast today, I've got a special request. We've heard from Kenya recently, and the care center that they opened to rescue these 300 orphan kids is being threatened with a shutdown by the government because they don't have enough beds and space for the kids they're housing there. They've asked for an additional $168,000. Yeah, I know it's a lot of money, but over the year, we've given through this podcast and live stream over $3 million to help in the care and needs of people in Kenya. This is probably the last thing we're going to do there. And if this podcast has ever meant anything to you, we've never asked for a dime. But if you ever wanted to do something to kind of give back, particularly in this season of gratitude, I'm going to ask you to consider, if you can afford it and if it's in your budget somewhere, to help us provide this money to help these kids be able to stay in this care center. You'll find more details in the podcast notes, or you can go to the blog at lifestream.org. It has information there. Again, every dime you give goes to Kenya. We don't take anything out here at Livestream at all for any reason. So please give it your thought and consideration. Now, on to the podcast.
I wish you could have been with me last Friday night, Kyle.
Last Friday night? Okay.
We recorded in the morning for the podcast. And then that night, I'm sitting around a fire pit, Damascus, Virginia, which is this little podunk town of 670 people in the middle of the Appalachian Trail. And the group have gathered around a fire pit and ostensibly to have a conversation with me. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of getting to know each other, just kind of talking. And I'm not the focus of the meeting yet. Everybody's talking and jiving. And some of the folks I know in there. Yeah. And this one guy starts to say, well, I asked, you know, Wayne and Sarah to come by here. And he said, because no one has influenced my view of church and he was talking about the book Finding Church. Now it just resonated so deeply. He's a former denominational guy.
Okay.
And I'm watching the woman sitting next to him. And she gets a startled look. It's in that kind of that dog inquisitive kind of tilt the head and look at me. And she goes, you're Wayne Jacobson. I'm like, oh my gosh. She hits her head. She falls back in her chair. Are you Wayne Jacobson? Well, yeah. Isn't that why you came? No, I have no idea. She went with a friend to dinner. She's actually leading a book study group on So You Don't Want Your Church Anymore.
Oh my gosh.
I'm one of her favorite people on the planet. Never met her before. And she goes into a full-on seizure, just that she's sitting around. I got to text this friend. I got to text that friend. I can't believe you're sitting here in Damascus, Virginia. Oh, it was hilarious. She was so gobsmacked and was for the rest of the evening. And yeah, she just totally, I don't think I've ever seen a reaction like that. Because most people who come to a meeting of mine know that's why they're coming.
That you're going to be there, and that's the whole intent of like, I want to go hang out with Wayne. So
yeah, she had a dinner with a friend who said, hey, they got this guy and his wife here from California. You want to go out and meet him? And that she came to the fire pit not having a clue
that one of her favorite authors was going to be sitting there.
It was just too good to be true.
Oh, that's awesome.
Had another encounter a few days later in Chattanooga with a lady who is the only woman on the planet who has mourned my passing.
Who has mourned your passing?
Yeah. She was talking to Sarah back in the days of our agony when we were separated. She was talking to Sarah one day on the phone. Okay. And Sarah told me that she had left Wayne. But what the late, and Sarah was in tears and all that, but what she heard was, I've lost Wayne. And then Sarah got another phone call and had to hang up and say, listen, I'm sorry, I'll call you right back. Sarah calls her back in about 40 minutes and she's in tears. And she goes, what happened? What happened? She said, what are you doing? She said, did Wayne die? And she said, no, Wayne has not died. I left him, which is bad enough, right? Anyway, she's the only person on the planet that has mourned my passing, so. That was fun to see her. She's a good family friend, kind of a surrogate daughter of ours who used to live in California, has now moved back here. And,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was. At one point, she made some cracker comment, and I texted her. We hadn't gotten there yet. And I said, well, not bad for a dead guy. And she texted me back, hashtag too soon, hashtag not funny, hashtag it will never not be too soon. that was a moment.
What do you do with that? Like, how do you manage those? Do you just laugh and move on? Or like, how do you manage those relational interactions?
Like I do with all pain in my life. I make a joke out of it. Something. Yeah. I say something jokey and try and bite her into, you know, cause, and she's joking too. She's a great joker. Yeah. She doesn't mind getting in my face about stuff. So it was just too funny. Cause she's the only person that thought I was dead for a 40 minute span of her life. She thought her surrogate kind of befriended father had passed away and Sarah was in mourning and it just ripped her heart out. And it was a little premature. As Mark Twain said, the rumors of my passing are a bit premature or something like that. So, I'm glad she didn't get on the phone and call a lot of people.
Yeah, that would have been really interesting. That would have been quite the firestorm that you would have been navigating.
And the things just keep continuing. I was in Atlanta, and a guy comes up to me afterwards, never met him before, he and his wife. They were in a meeting with us for a couple hours, and then he just came up and said, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I want to tell you something I'm doing. I said, what's that? He said, I'm sending every one of my children, adult children, a copy of He Loves Me, and telling them that if I had a do-over as a parent, this is what I want them to know about God instead of the legalistic things I taught them. Which I thought, man, I might send it to my kids. Who knows? That's a great idea. Just, and he said, I know they may not read it for a year or two because they're all, you know, raised in that legalism thing, kind of, you know, just distancing themselves from the whole religious milieu and probably God too.
Yeah.
And just something that gentle that just said, if I had a do-over, this is what I would want. This is what I wished I would have taught you about God. Mm. I think if everybody in the world did that, that'd be awesome. But what about self-serving? And then my last encounter this week that I just think is hilarious. This was two nights ago. We're in a meeting here in Nashville. And Sarah, they're asking Sarah about some trauma. So she's talking to stuff. And she gets into that thing where she said, the thing I hate is when people ask me, what's your favorite this? What's your favorite that? She said, I don't have a favorite movie. I don't have a favorite place. I don't have a favorite. And then she got this smile on her face, reached over and touched me. I was like, I do have a favorite author, she says.
Nice. That's got to be the best thing you heard this week.
It was the best thing I heard this week. My goodness, my wife. And it wasn't just that she's saying something nice about me. It wasn't that. It was that Sarah, in talking about trauma with a room full of people, many of which she had not known before that evening, she's relaxed enough for a line like that to pop in her head, relaxed enough to use that line for the humor of the moment to say, I mean, just, it was all hilarious because people were going, man, I said, I had no idea. This is not something she's ever said before, but I am her favorite author. And she has a favorite. We found a favorite.
We found a favorite.
So we've had a lot of fun with that ever since. So that's been good. Best thing I heard this week. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And we want to welcome you to this edition of The God Journey. I'm from Nashville, Tennessee today, moving on to Paducah, Kentucky, and then Arkansas. And we've got people in this podunk town in Arkansas. Lots of God Journey listeners around there. Want to come
really?
In? So, yeah, it's way out of the way. But we're only going there because Sarah and I have a lifelong family friend who lives there now. We've not seen her in about a decade.
Okay.
Her husband passed away from leukemia a while back, and we're just excited to see her. Then all these other people just say, hey, if you're there, we're here. And so that's going to be fun.
That's awesome.
We moved to Oklahoma, Texas, and then making our way home from there.
Then you actually have California in your sights.
We have a plan now that gets us to California on Thanksgiving Day because my family doesn't celebrate till the day after.
Okay.
So we figure that'd be a good day to drive into L.A. Most people hopefully will be somewhere. They won't be for Thanksgiving, and we're not.
You might actually not have traffic.
It seemed like Wednesday was a bad day to try and drive into LA, so we've decided to come in on Thursday.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. I remember there was two times that Jess and I tried to drive out of Los Angeles the day before Thanksgiving, and I would never wish that on a human being ever. Unless you're wanting a lot of uninterrupted car time with somebody, don't drive in Los Angeles.
Because you're basically not driving. You're basically sitting in a long, long parking lot.
Correct. Exactly. That extends for several, mile after mile after mile after mile. Yes.
Yeah. Not a way to do it. So what's the best thing you heard this week, Kyle?
I actually got a
a really sweet text from my wife this week.
I got it from my wife. You got your best thing you heard this week from your wife. This is a good week.
I did get the best thing from my wife. Halloween and one of Jess's favorite holidays, if not her favorite holiday, is Halloween because she gets to dress up as somebody else and she loves doing makeup and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
And so I went and was doing some work for my dad and it ended up being a frustrating day. Like there was a bunch of things that were going wrong and I wanted to be with my family, but also had committed to finishing this project. And so I get done with a really long day of work, haven't even finished the day yet, but I'm like, no, I'm going to go in, I'm going to spend some time with my wife and with my girls, and then I'll go back and I'll finish the work in the dark and, you know, wrap it up. Yep. And so then the next day, Jess sent me this text message and said, thank you for choosing us and coming out to hang out with us after what sounds like a pretty hard day. I hope it wasn't all bad. I love you. And it was wonderful to see you. And that, like, thank you for choosing us. That was really tender. You know, for her to be able to see that and to verbalize that to me when I was feeling like, oh my gosh, like I didn't want to be doing that project necessarily, but needed to, you know, just, we had a couple bills come in. And so I needed to put in some extra hours, and just for her to be able to say that when I was missing my family and missing not being able to be with them on a day that they loved having together was very sweet. So
were you in costume?
I was not in costume. I was actually
You could have gone as ranch hand cowboy worker or something, right?
That is what I went as, which was grease covered and hands that were black from dirt. And yes.
Well, then you had a costume. What was she?
I didn't have a costume. Jess was a butterfly. Her and Elle wanted to be a butterfly. And so Jess did the full face makeup with the little jewels and everything. And then Elle wanted mom to be a butterfly as well. So mom was a butterfly and Evie was a puppy. So she should have been a little Ewok, but she was a puppy.
aren't you glad you weren't a butterfly?
I am. Yes. I felt more like somebody in a chrysalis than I felt more like a caterpillar that was just crawling into the chrysalis than a worm or than a butterfly.
It probably looked like that too.
Yes. That is exactly how I looked.
Oh. Oh, wow. So what are you going to talk about this week, Kyle?
Well, you sent me something a while ago.
Yeah, we've been carrying this around a while.
We have been carrying this around a little while. And it just really, for me, it comes back to some interesting conversations that I had with some students and with some clients this week. And just really around the idea of what does it look like to walk in the kingdom of God and in his freedom, in his grace? What does it look like to actually walk in rest, love, and play? Versus the way that the world tries to manage human behavior. And so it's the 7 rules of unhealthy adult child group systems. So talking about parenting adult children. And you sent this to me. It's by Jane Bluestein, PhD. What is her PhD in?
I know nothing about this. Okay. This was sent to me by a man named Bud, who was listening to God Journey and thought we'd enjoy looking over this list, which I have.
Mm-hmm.
Says the information is known as the poisonous pedagogy. It was taken from far your own good, hidden cruelty in child rearing, and the roots of violence by Alice Miller. And I know nothing about these people. I know nothing about the book that was quoted from or the person who came up with it. But I thought it was an interesting list given not just parenting. It's not really about that to me. It's more about how we view God and the way God parents us and the way we love others out of it. So, yeah, it does deal with unhealthy adult child group systems. It really, I don't know what she's aiming at there, whether it's extended family or it's church. There's a lot of church overtones to it because it really speaks to some of the poisonous pedagogy of religious people.
Yes.
Which I don't know if that's where this is actually being covered, but to me, that's where I see it apply. And I thought, again, not knowing anything but the statements themselves.
Correct.
That's all I have. Correct. I have this quote. I haven't read anything, but a lack of information never keeps me from commenting. So I thought it might be kind of fun given the fact that you've got young kids you're raising and you're dealing with some of this stuff. I've got adult children that we deal with similar things. And I thought this was so such a great list to talk about, particularly in our relationship with God. And I think actually the chart that we've been doing.
Yes.
I think this really invites us, because the place we're stuck in this chart is love, rest, and play.
Yep.
We've not gotten back to moving on from that.
Yeah.
I think we've been demonstrating that in Sarah's transformation and in our relationship, you with your family. I think we're kind of processing what love, rest, and play really looks like inside a relationship with God, and how transformation comes out of that. That it doesn't come out of the white knuckled authoritarian obedience to God stuff. In fact, twice this last week in conversations, I've run up against the whole Stockholm syndrome view of God. I don't really love him, not really endeared to him, but he's got the really bad stuff. If you don't at least try and keep him happy.
Yeah.
And so they struggle with that whole idea of an affectionate, tender, engaging God is outside the scope of their religious experience. And they're struggling with it, which I think is amazing.
Because that goes back to that old perception, what we were talking about what is salvation, right? And if it's just like, I've got to keep this guy in the sky happy so that he doesn't withdraw my eternity card to where I don't burn in hell for the rest of my life, like, or for the rest of eternity after I die. Like, yeah, that's not somebody, I mean, yeah, you don't want to tick him off, but that's not somebody you want to hang out with, versus somebody who is inviting you into tenderness and love and wholeheartedness in the here and now. And that's an extension of the kingdom that he's drawing us into for the rest of our days.
Yeah, we were with someone yesterday here in Nashville. We went to a tourist thing, a historical thing, and got talking about the cross and appeasement and just the whole idea of the people who most believe the cross was about appeasing God spend all of their lives continuing to appease God. If you really believe the cross was about appeasement and that God satisfied in himself everything he would ever require of us, then church attendance, Bible reading, as a way to stay in God's favor goes away.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. Those people like still have to keep the card.
Yes.
I got the card. Now I got to keep the card.
Yep. I got to maintain it.
Instead of, wow, when you really see God as enduring, engaging, that what he died on the cross for was to re-engage us in a relationship with him out of that restored innocence, out of love, rest, and play, inside the loving delight of a father who out of that shapes and transforms you.
Yeah.
And if you've never experienced that, all you know is when people start talking about freedom, well, people are just going to go off and do whatever they want to do. Correct. And they're going to stop reading their Bible and they're going to stop doing this and they're going to get divorced. And they just have this litany of, I hold on to my appeasement because that's the only thing that makes my life make sense. Instead of, if you really learn, I mean, really learn what love, rest, and play is inside the Father, it changes your whole view of life and what you want to do with him rather than have to do to keep him on his good side.
Yeah.
And if you've not been there, all you see is freedom as a threat. And I said that the other day in a video about how when the love of God is a threat to us. Sarah and I were talking about that. I think I've been loving her better over the last 10 years. After Russia, I really do. I've been praying that prayer every day. Father, help me love Sarah today the way you want Sarah loved. I want to be your best. And I was loving her better, but her trauma considered that a threat. The love was not engaging to a tormented soul. The love was painful. And I think I see that with God and so many people who want to walk in the love of God. God's love doesn't come to them in the package they expect, this soothing, quiet, everything's great, God's answered all my prayers kind of thing. But God's love comes with a taste of light and a taste of kindness and an offer of intimacy that threatens a broken human heart. So we're actually running from the God we say we want to discover.
Yeah, because like we were talking about earlier, about how truth and God's loving truth is so threatening to trauma that wants to stay in the dark, that doesn't want to come to the surface, that doesn't want to be revealed, right? That pain is allowed to continue to manifest as long as it's not called out and brought into the light to where it can actually be healed and it can be challenged by the truth of a loving Father and loving kingdom.
It's like you in your bunker where you're talking about people trying to love you inside your bunker were the biggest threat to I've got to. And I think that's God's deal with trying to love broken people. The closer I get to them, the more threatened they are because I mean, they want love in a package that is a come in because it comes in a God package.
Correct.
Which is the ultimate soothe and the ultimate heal and the ultimate all that. But until you find that reality, then you're running from the very thing you say you want. When people say, you know, God doesn't love me, he doesn't care, I never feel God's love. It's not that he's not there for you.
Yeah.
It's that somehow you might be perceiving it as a threat. So let's go over these 7 rules of unhealthy adult child group systems before we run out of time. The first one is adults are the masters of the dependent child.
Mm.
Now, I don't know how this plays into adult child systems, because this is the dependent child is usually, you know, younger, not 16, 17, 18.
Well, that used to be the case. Now in modern times, that is not the case anymore.
That the parents are not the masters?
Well, no, we're seeing a level of dependency going much later into, you know, late teens, early 20s, even mid 20s.
But the whole idea, the adult is the master. I am your father. That's why. I am the mother. That's why. We make the rules. All those people in my generation that were raised on dare to discipline or the rebellious child or whatever, that's embedded in that. The adult knows everything.
Yeah.
So the child just shut up and go along. And that actually feeds the rebellion we're trying to mitigate. It actually does. Because God made kids to be decision makers. And when they feel like their parents are just forcing the dependent child to do what they want, that acts out in all kinds of rebellion.
And I read through this list, and we'll get through the rest of them. But as I read through this list, like it really churned up my yuck meter.
Mine too.
Both towards like looking at my own behaviors, like, oh man, like this stuff is still embedded in the way that I view parenting and the way that I'm addressing my kids. And granted, that's been shifting, but like, I see so much of this in conservative evangelical teaching that this is, you know, even going back to like focus on the family. And I listened to some, and not to say that Adventures in Odyssey is a bad thing. I think that a lot of that stuff can be great, but I even listened to some of that the other day with my girls. And there was a major undertone of this, like submission to the master and the parents know what's best and you just need to get on board with it. Like, it's like, oh my gosh, like what?
Man. Yeah, and the second one's almost exactly the same. Adults determine in a godlike fashion what is right and what is wrong. And if you've ever been a parent, man, you know you weren't always right when you were trying to pretend
Correct.
You were right.
Oh, my God.
And the kids know that. I knew that when my parents were growing up. Okay, they think they're right. I get it, but they're not. But they have power over you. They're feeding you. They're clothing you. So you've got to go along with this thing. And where these things hit me, Kyle, was thinking that's how we view God. And he actually does know the difference between right and wrong. He actually does.
Yeah.
He's perfect about that. But the application of masters of the dependent child, and so much in religion about obedience to God, even when you hate it. That's why the love, rest, and play is such a challenge to people.
Yeah.
Because they don't think of God in that construct. No, God's the ultimate authority. He knows right and wrong. But God's coming to us in a way not to say, look, I'm right and just do it. I've got to change you from the inside so that you can be free to live in my reality. It's still light that God wants us to live in, but it's not this top-down, enforced, angry, judgmental way that we believed God was treating us, and that's then the way we treated our kids. Sarah even had a shirt, because I'm the mom, that's why. Mm. And we look at that shirt now, and it pegs our young. We don't have the shirt anymore. But that comes up at times, Sarah and I think about it, I go, that was disgusting. Mm. And it was. It didn't treat the child as if they were an individual. And yes, no, parents got to give a lot of guidance to children.
Yeah.
No, we're not saying that's not true. Yeah. But if you can do that in love, rest, and play, rather than pulling the authoritarian card, then you're being more godlike, because God's not pulling the authoritarian card when he invites us in Christ to come boldly before the throne of grace, to be confident with him, not confident in arrogance, but just confident that I belong there as his, as you and Sarah got into it last week, as his special child.
Yeah.
And we're all his special child, and he gets to invite us into that.
Well, and the thing that for me that really stands out too in this is, like, for me, like the godlike fashion, that's like, even thinking about, I had a situation with Elle last night, and I'm working I'm working on just really pursuing that relationship and trying to build and fortify that relationship right now. And one of the things that came up is like that I'm presuming to know exactly what she needs. Instead of having the humility to say, okay, yes, I recognize that there are things that for her safety and for her well-being, I know that she needs. But then there's also that humility to pause and say, what does my daughter need? What is her heart asking for? Right. And thinking
back, that's legitimate.
Yes, exactly.
That's a legitimate ask.
Yes. And thinking back to the ways that God has positioned his heart there too. Of saying, no, I invite you to have that conversation with me. Tell me what is on your heart. I want you to have the freedom to feel safe in my presence, to be able to just process whatever you feel like your heart needs. Well, I would love your feedback on this. So often, the feedback that we get from the religious community, at least that I got, was you can't trust that. You can't trust what you think you need or what you think your heart wants. Like, you have to live in this like this authoritarian relationship with God, because there's no way that you could actually know what you need. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how would you respond to that?
That'd be a real interesting look at what is a felt need, because I've had a lot of felt needs that were needs.
Oh, absolutely.
And when you're an author, what they teach you is how to write to felt needs. Because that's what sells books. So actually coddling the very audience, because you're not really helping them look beyond felt needs to what is the real need beneath the felt need. Like the felt need, I need ice cream and I need it right now.
Yeah.
But the real need is I'm missing my dad. I need some attachment, attunement to my father. That would be a legitimate need. Ice cream isn't necessarily the answer to that.
Yeah.
But like you're saying, if you zoom in on the real need, that then you're in a place to really help a child or help someone. And we do that with adults too. Always, mostly what adults are asking for is not ultimately what they need.
Yeah.
So does God know better? Yes. Does God just say, well, then we shouldn't trust what we know? It'd be really good to ask God for what we need and then process with God to discover what it is that we really need. Now, yes. That to me would be the ultimate, because I think prayer is meant to be a conversation to get us to God's goodness, not I get God to give me the thing I think I want or need.
Yeah.
But to really find out, what are you doing and how do we get there, God? And and love, rest, and play will get you there.
Yeah.
And the authority won't.
Well, and the thing that I was actually having a conversation with somebody about this earlier this week, and the dialogue about, okay, this was the question that you initially asked me, and yet these were the underlying heart questions that were going on that was informing that initial question that you asked, right? Like, and so as we begin to recognize that, and I think as God invites us into recognizing, okay, what is my heart actually asking for? You know, like what you were saying is like, what is the underlying longing or what is the underlying need that's being highlighted by this question? And okay, Father, this is how the initial question is being presented, but I want to walk with you relationally and see what else is going on in there. What else is coming up? What else is resulting in that? And how would you speak to that, Lord? Like, how would you respond? What does rest, love, and play look like in that with you?
And you did that with Sarah last week when she was talking about specialness. And you kind of got beneath what she was feeling. Like, well, how do I deserve this? Mm. It's not a matter of being more special than anybody else. It's just we're all special to God. And revel in the specialness of what he's done for you without elevating yourself above other people. So the next one was, the child is held responsible for the anger of the adult. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man.
This is where my bad parenting, I tell you what, anger was such a trigger for me in my pre-loved days. And I have so many regrets around this right here, that when a child made me angry, it was their fault because they knew better and they should have. And then the adult feels justified in the anger, instead of responding out of a much healthier way. And when I read that line, I go, that's exactly what every abusive man does to his wife, that she's responsible for his anger. She didn't cook the dinner right. She didn't do that on time. She didn't. So my anger is not my problem. My anger is your problem. Oh, gosh.
the abuse that you're now receiving is a result of your choices and your action, and I can't help myself. You triggered this, and now you've got to just accept it. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm.
Mm-mm. Oh, and that we have an angry God, right? The children in the hands of an angry God, one of the most coveted sermons, because it really meant to manipulate and scare the Jesus out of people. And literally, probably, the Jesus out of people. And that's, and just, man, you're responsible for your own anger. Yeah. And I get this a lot from people. I get it from some of my whole family right now. You're angry with me, and I didn't do what you're saying I did. Mm. But I'm responsible for your anger. And I'm not. When I see angry people now, because I used to be one, still can get angry now and then, but not nearly as much. When I get angry people who are trying to manipulate me, what I already know is this is a manipulation going on. Because if you come at me humbly, kindly, tenderly, we'll have a much better discussion.
Oh, yeah.
Which is God, love, rest, and play. If you come at me kindly, tenderly, that's how I'm coming to you. Even when I know things are broken in your life and I know I want to shape things. The fourth one, we got to keep moving. I'll get through these. The fourth one, the adults must always be shielded. I had a little taste of that yesterday, though. We're meeting this couple to go through the Hermitage, which is Andrew Jackson's home here in Tennessee. They're our seventh president of the United States. And Sarah and I are really into history and presidential things. They wanted to go with us. And they said, do you mind if we bring our 8 and 10-year-old kids? Mm. And we said, no, it's fine. So, well, we know things are different when kids are around. And that's coming from that, which we've all gone to quote unquote church services where the kids are all siphoned off elsewhere in the bowels of the building, that kids get put at children's tables at Thanksgiving or whatever. We kind of diminish children because adults need to be shielded from the exuberance and, you know, lack of discipline or whatever with kids. Instead, I said, no, bring the kids. If you want to bring the kids, they'll be a distraction to you more than us. We're happy to be with your kids and have lunch with them and talk to them. We're happy to include them. That was Jesus, right? They're trying to shoo all the kids away from him. And he goes, no, let the kids come to me. But the idea that adults must always be shielded from children, that is a bias underneath Western culture.
Like the thought that came through my head is, as you were talking about that, is why do we so quickly want to avoid the disruption, right? Like we as adults think that our worlds are so, I'm speaking to myself right now. I'm thinking about this right now. And I'm like, I think that my things that are going on in my life are so much more valuable. And then one of my girls will do something and it'll be a disruption and it'll be kind of chaotic and, you know, whatever. And I'll be like, oh, you know, I've got to, but it's like, oh my gosh, Kyle, like rest, love, and play, laugh with your daughters, re-engage with that. Like this, don't take, why so serious, Rice? Like quit taking yourself so serious, get over yourself and enjoy, accept the invitation to play instead of this space where it's like, oh no, I'm going to shield you from the disruption of the joy, the awe, the unencumbered passion that you see in kids that we so quickly try to pull out of people. And then we spend the rest of our adult lives trying to get back there. And yet we don't like the disruption. Oh my gosh. Yeah,
as this trauma is losing hold on Sarah's life and experience, man, the love, rest, and play I'm experiencing with her, even the line she used the other night about, well, I do have a favorite author. Just the playfulness of that is such a testimony to the trauma and not all sin is trauma. Trauma is a really unique thing. I don't want to diminish, but I see many parallels between how sin impacts us and how trauma impacts.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And it keeps us from that love, rest, and play. And it keeps, you know, God's got to be shielded from the bad stuff. God doesn't need to be shielded from the bad stuff or the disruptive things in your life or your anger or whatever. Let's get the rest of these. The child's life-affirming feelings pose a threat to the autocratic adult. We've probably already covered this, but it's profound just to hear it that way. The life-affirming feelings that I matter, I count, see me, daddy, I'm here. And yet adults think that, well, that's against the, I'm telling you what to do and you just do it. Children are to be seen and not heard. All that crud.
I have to share this like moment last night where it was definitely a divine intervention, honestly. So last night was a bit of a rough night. Both the girls were kind of struggling and I took Evie up, like, we're trying to sleep train Evie, and so I'm sleeping downstairs with Evie, and Jess is sleeping upstairs with Elle, so that we are not waking both the girls up, and et cetera. Anyway, so yeah. Evie was wet. She had peed so much that she, like, got herself soaked, and so I had to, so I cleaned her and took her upstairs because she was hungry. Well, Elle had literally just climbed into bed with Jess, and Jess was like, well, Elle's going to go downstairs and sleep with you. And so I was like, okay, whatever. And so she comes downstairs, and I get this water. She's like, Daddy, I need some water. I was like, okay. So I run up and get this new water bottle that Jess had just gotten for her that's supposed to be sealed so that she can sleep with it and not get wet. Well, it was not sealed. So about 10 minutes into to Elle and I sleeping, the water is all over my bed with her. She's wet. I'm wet, whatever. And I, like, chuck the water bottle because this is at 3:30 in the morning and I'm exhausted, yeah. Right? And I chuck the water bottle, and Elle was like, Daddy, are you angry at me? And I was like, no, sweetheart. I was like, my frustration has nothing to do with you and everything to do with the water bottle that just leaked over you and I. Like, yeah. You did nothing wrong. Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, but... For me to be able to respond like that at 3:30 in the morning is like, okay, that was divine intervention. Yeah. Like, that was not me. That was definitely divine intervention. But I think about that and it's like, that was a life affirming feeling. She's like, are you angry at me? It's like, no, sweetheart. Yeah, no, I'm frustrated at the situation, not at you. I love you. Like, and then she snuggled up against me and fell back asleep. And it was just like this, oh, like, sweet. Thank you, Lord.
Last 2 hours, number six, the child's will must be broken as soon as possible. That was taught all over the place when I was young. Even as I got in my early days of ministry, you got to break a child like you break a horse. And now they're not even breaking horses. They're finding ways to touch the heart of a horse so that it love, rest, and play enjoys being with its rider, not broken and fearful and terrified. And to me, that's so, for people wrestling out a relationship with God, if it's out of fear and pressure and fear of making a mistake, fear of getting it wrong, whatever, you're missing it.
Yeah.
Because God's love, rest, and play is, I want to be with you. God's not trying to break you. He's trying to win you into his love.
Yeah.
Win you into his, because he knows once he has that, everything he wants to do in you, through you, is going to get done.
Yeah.
And when you're living in this needing, and I've heard that whole teaching of, you know, breaking a sheep's leg so the sheep will have to hang out with the shepherd.
And oh my gosh, yes.
So much of that crud got taught and believed. And then people see God as, when they actually come to the end of themselves and God opens his heart to them in a new way, they're going, yeah, God broke me, which I think is really bad terminology. Yeah. God didn't break you. You finally got to the end of yourself and were able to see the God who was loving you, not breaking you. But that analogy, that played a lot back in the day. Or
absolutely. Eagle
breaking its beak on a rock. And the whole idea of breaking a horse, breaking a child, it's reprehensible to me now. And yet I was raised in it as very normal. And the last one, then we can talk about either of those you want to. All of this must happen at a very early age so the child won't notice and will not be able to expose the adults. Now this,
oh man,
this really gets to the adult child systems talk, because this one I would never have been aware of till she says it. And no one ever said, hey, break your kid early. No one says this, at least that I know of, but doggone, did this not happen?
Oh yeah.
You got to get, I mean, the whole strong-willed child or dare to do, you got to get that child by the time they're 7 or 8. Or that rebellion will act out. And then when the rebellion acts out, you've got to double down. And the whole idea is the parents are always right. And if the kids don't recognize that and get broken at a young age, they'll expose the illusion of the adults. Poking holes in illusions again, right?
Yes.
Those last two are so powerful. The idea of breaking a child and then doing it at such an early age that they don't see through the system that's manipulating them.
Yeah. And event that, oh man, it's so toxic because eventually they will, right? Eventually, like the difference versus that versus loving your kids on purpose, you know, by Danny Silk and that whole conversation, or even honestly, I was thinking about, you know, the child's will must be broken. And we were talking about, like, you know, breaking the leg, et cetera, versus the language in Hosea of, I'm going to hem you in. Right? Like, it wasn't a breaking. It was a, I'm going to give you a more controlled and safe space to where you can learn that your way of doing life is causing the pain.
Yes.
And that I have a way through this in love that can make that valley of trouble into a doorway of hope for you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh my gosh. Like, he's not breaking them. He's not snapping their legs. He's like, I'm going to hem you in with a loving barrier so that you're not able to keep going down this road of pain into a space where you may feel like you can't come back from it.
Yeah. Now, these are some great things to kind of process out for people. I think I'll list them in the podcast notes. So you can copy the list and kind of think about it yourself. But
yeah,
I tell you what, this is how we got life and God so confused. The whole religious expression of the autocratic, authoritative, demanding God, you got to be obedient no matter what. You can't question anything. You can't. And learning to live inside that, which we've been talking about for weeks now, the love, rest, and play of God inviting us into his love, inviting us into his rest. And then out of the playfulness,
yeah.
I mean, a lot of Sarah's healing and trauma right now is coming out of a lot of playfulness between us. Sarah's actually learning to play. And the play is both a fruit of what God's doing, and it's also the conduit of carrying it further. And my relationship with God over the last few years, play, even in the midst of great pain and suffering, playing with God is how he plays us into his reality, where we're less defensive, less threatened by what our needs are, and are able then to come alongside his in a beautiful way. And I love that.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com